It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, wolf attacks on cattle and hunting dogs in Wisconsin are up. We'll get the details.
First, Assembly Republicans unveiled their plan for the upcoming legislative session in January. The Forward plan includes proposals to enhance education, provide road funding, and balance the budget.
And questions have been raised about the feasibility of some of those plans and how the Assembly will sell them to the state Senate and to Governor Walker.
Joining us now to talk about the plan is Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, there's a lot of details in this Forward plan from Assembly Republicans. Let's start with education. Big strokes, broad strokes, what are they talking about for education?
So they said that education, particularly K-12 education, was going to be a high priority for Assembly Republicans in the next legislative session. In particular, they said one of their highest priorities will be a bill that would provide a laptop or a tablet computer to every high school freshman in the state.
Yeah, here's a listen to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. This is kind of a novel budget item here. Let's give a listen.
Almost every single assignment that are given to students today is to be done either using the internet or using technology. For kids to not have access to devices or to not have access to the internet really puts them behind the curve.
A lot of years we hear we have tight budgets, difficult times to pay for things. This doesn't sound like it would be a freebie, certainly. Is there talk of how they'd pay for this laptop proposal?
You know, Rob, the speaker didn't say how they plan to pay for it. And I actually reached out to his office yesterday and they said that it's one of their legislative priorities, and the funding will be figured out when they start talking about the budget. So we certainly don't have specifics. There was some chatter yesterday that this program could potentially be expensive because it would be providing a laptop or a tablet to every high school freshman. So it's not based on income. There's no voucher or application. It's every student across the state, public, private, charter school. So we'll have to stay tuned to how legislators think they're going to pay for that program.
One of the most controversial budget items, even within the Republican Party, not just between parties, has been transportation and road funding. What are we hearing from Republicans as far as meeting what's been described as a shortfall in road maintenance and building funding in the state?
Yes, so transportation is definitely a hot topic in legislative action these days. They spent quite a bit of time yesterday talking about the Assembly GOP's perspective on the transportation budget debate. Speaker Voss said that all options should be on the table. He sort of echoed the sentiment that we've heard from Representative John Nygren, who's one of the co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee, who has said that, you know, we should consider increasing vehicle registration fees, possibly, you know, getting some new revenue in there, which is something that the governor has said he's opposed to unless there's an equivalent cut. So it's very apparent that the governor, the assembly, and the Senate are certainly not on the same page in terms of closing that transportation budget gap as of right now. But the assembly GOP's official stance is we need all options on the table. They're not so hot on borrowing, and they're particularly looking forward to an audit of the transportation department that's going to come out later this year to see if they can actually save some money, make some cuts, before they potentially introduce some new fees.
This is where it starts to get tricky, though. I think a lot of parties here think we need to do something. We need to find some options. Nobody agrees on what it is. It sounds like this assembly plan doesn't spell out here is exactly how we want to close this funding gap.
No, not at all. I think everybody's being a little cautious right now because there is a lot of disagreement. So I think we're kind of tiptoeing into this debate. I think there's a lot of anticipation and some hope that some common ground can be found. Representative John Nygren, as I mentioned earlier, co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, has been trying to involve the public in this debate, sort of getting people engaged with local governments, which handle a lot of road projects, obviously. So we're just going to have to see how this evolves. But the major branches of government right now in Wisconsin are just not on the same page in terms of transportation funding.
We're talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White, looking at a new legislative agenda from Assembly Republicans on the eve, give or take, a couple of months of Election Day. Laurel, moving on to some other issues that came up, public safety and crime. What did we hear from Assembly Republicans?
Well, that was another one of their major priorities. So they broke down this legislative agenda document into three sections: economy, education and workforce development, and then health and public safety. So Speaker Robin Voss was actually asked a question about, you know, what do we do in the wake of the unrest in Milwaukee to ensure that our communities are safer? And he said one of the ways that we could do that would be to reform prison sentencing in the state and actually extend prison sentences for certain serious crimes.
Yeah, let's again give a listen to Robin Voss.
One of the things that I have been deeply disappointed in is the amount of people in this revolving door system where they are either not charged with serious enough crimes or their prison sentences or jail terms are far too short for what I view as the seriousness of their crimes.
Now, that's kind of more old school tough on crime than we've been hearing lately, even from Republicans. Are they putting this in a context of wider changes in our criminal justice system?
Well, Speaker Voss did mention that some of those changes might also include alterations to sentencing for minor crimes. So decreasing sentences for minor crimes as you're increasing sentences for more serious ones. He said that there might be some legislation to increase the number of prosecutors. And he also mentioned getting more law enforcement on the streets. Now, that's not something that the state legislature actually has direct purview over, but he said that they'd be looking to encourage communities like Milwaukee to get more law enforcement officers on the streets.
The agenda also includes a Blue Lives Matter bill. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Yeah, so that got quite a bit of airtime yesterday during this press conference, which ran about an hour in the state capitol. So the Blue Lives Matter bill is a bill that would make any crime against a law enforcement official a hate crime. So it would increase the penalty for any crime committed against a law enforcement officer. And that's something that's come up in the wake of some of the violence against police across the country and some of the unrest. And the Assembly GOP really threw their weight behind that bill, which we heard earlier this summer is going to be introduced in the next session.
Big picture on the budget. What did Assembly Republicans say about revenue versus spending?
Well, they're certainly not on board with borrowing. That was a big debate during the last legislative session. Assembly Republicans really balked at the amount of borrowing that the governor and others had advanced. So we know that they're not going to be supportive of that. Essentially, what we heard yesterday was that all options need to be on the table, and we know it's going to be another tough budget cycle coming up for 2017-2019.
This plan, of course, from Republicans. Did you hear response from Democrats in the legislature?
We heard from Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca, and he said that the Assembly Republicans' plan really didn't have any new ideas in it. And he also said that sometimes Assembly Republicans haven't been entirely forthright about what their actual plans are. That was Barca's alleged position. Well, that was his position. He alleged that. He said that when Assembly Republicans shared their agendas in the past, they didn't mention things like right to work legislation. So I think the message from Barca there was we might not have the full story about what the agenda is from Assembly Republicans, but it certainly was an expansive document that was released yesterday. A lot of ideas, 30 pages of bills. So we have a lot to look at there.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She joined us to talk about the legislative plan that Assembly Republicans unveiled yesterday. On Monday, you can hear an in-depth conversation about the plan with lawmakers at 7 a.m. on The Joy Cardine Show. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, a guest astronomer lays out the best possible options for finding alien life in the universe.
First, according to DNR statistics, wolf attacks on cattle and hunting dogs in Wisconsin are on the rise. The numbers come at a time when the Great Lakes wolf is back on the endangered species list. The numbers have raised questions and highlighted differences between conservationists and hunters and farmers.
Scott Hingstrom is a UW Extension wildlife specialist, the director of the Wisconsin Center for Wildlife, and faculty member of the College of Natural Resources at UW-Stevens Point. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Marana. Veronica.
Well, Scott, what are the latest numbers on wolf attacks on hunting dogs and cattle?
Well, as far as hunting dogs, hound dogs, we've lost 29 dogs to wolves in the state of Wisconsin just in 2016. And so we're quite concerned about that number because the high in the past has been 26 dogs over a year. So we've already surpassed the total, you know, the high number on annual basis, and we haven't even gotten into the bear season yet. And so loss of hounds is high. And also loss of cattle and calves is pretty high this year as well. We're not quite at record numbers, but we're on that trajectory. And so we've lost in the neighborhood of 100 calves to wolves and around 15 cattle. That's statewide. And so there are concerns out there.
What happens during bear season?
During bear season, that's the time when some hunters will use hound dogs to chase bears. It's a part of a northern Wisconsin tradition. And when bears encounter wolves in the wild, especially if they're in the area of what we call rendezvous sites, that's where you have the packs and they congregate with their younger pups. And this is especially a problem in the summertime. The wolves become very defensive and protective of their pups, and they'll kill other potential predators, such as dogs. And so we've lost most of these hunting dogs in the summertime, but it still can happen later on as we get into the bear hunting season, which just is a couple of weeks away.
Now, as I understand it, the wolf is back on the endangered species list. It's been sort of on and off and on and off, which means right now they're off limits for hunters. Can you give us a quick history of the wolf status in Wisconsin on that list in the last several years?
Oh, my, a quick history. You're absolutely right as far as the on-off, on-off. It's a matter of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed that the wolf be delisted from being an endangered species because it's perceived that we have suitable number of wolves in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Upper Michigan. But then there have been court injunctions against that delisting. And so over the last, since about 2007, the wolf has been on and off and on and off the endangered species list at least four times. And so it's a bit of a pendulum swing, and that it's unfortunate. I like to see moderation in our environment, and the wolves being on the endangered species list currently, landowners have limited options as far as protecting their own resources. And so, for example, if a wolf came in and killed a cow or calf in their backyard or on their farm, they couldn't legally shoot or trap that wolf. They would have to implement some non-lethal form of control. And the same is true with our management agencies like the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources or USDA Wildlife Services. They only have the non-lethal control tools at their disposal currently, unless if a wolf was posing a direct threat to human health and safety.
We've got a caller I want to take on. Marty is with us right now from Menominee. Marty, hello.
Hi, I'm going to be quick because I'm driving and I don't like to talk and drive. We've been fighting bear dogs, using bear dogs to hunt bear in Wisconsin for 25 years now. If the hunters were unable to use dogs anymore, then we wouldn't be losing dogs to wolves. The dogs are being trained in the summer in areas in which the pups are vulnerable. The wolf pups are vulnerable, and as your guest said, they're getting killed because of that. Quit using bear dogs. We won't lose them anymore.
Marty, thanks for the call. And what is the argument there that Marty's getting at? Is getting at a debate, I'm sensing here.
Well, there certainly is a debate because you have people of differing attitudes and values. There is a very strong contingent of people who choose to use dogs for bear hunting. And I might draw a parallel in that there's a large number of people who like to use dogs for bird hunting, of which myself, I raise and train dogs, and I love that. And the connection with those dogs is very, very important to me. And I don't have bear hounds, but I can see that many bear hunters may have the same type of connection to their dogs as I have to mine or other bird hunters do. And so I'm not going to reject the idea of bear hunting with dogs. There are other ways to hunt bears. You can bait bears, and a lot of people have problems with people putting out bait to lure bears into an area. You can try to still hunt bears or use other forms, but the success rates are very low. And so, you know, this bear hunting with dogs and with hounds is very much a Wisconsin tradition. And so, but it does have problems. The caller does reflect on the point that when these wolves bring their pups out of their dens in the late spring, early summer, and they meet in areas that we call these rendezvous sites, the packs are very protective of the pups. And if a dog happens to be coming through there chasing a bear in a training period, the wolves may attack that dog. And so Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has posted many maps online where bear hunters can check out where wolf packs have been observed and where there have been attacks on dogs. And they're encouraged to avoid those areas. But sometimes we don't know where these rendezvous sites are. In fact, most cases we don't know where they are. And so these bear dogs do get in trouble, especially during this rendezvous period.
We're talking with Scott Hingstrom right now. He's a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Director of the Wisconsin Center for Wildlife, looking at the wolf population in Wisconsin. Now, State Senator Tom Tiffany of Hazelhurst has been blaming wolves for what he calls an unsatisfactory experience for deer hunters in Wisconsin. And he's calling for a wolf summit and also for the wolf to be pulled off that endangered species list. What case is he making there when it comes to wolves being responsible for maybe subpar deer hunting?
Sure. Well, as far as the wolf numbers in the state of Wisconsin, I can't say we're at an all-time high because before human settlement, we probably had thousands of wolves in the state of Wisconsin. But when I was here as a graduate student in the early 1980s, we had 18 wolves that were known of in the state of Wisconsin, just 18. And over winter, there were surveys done this past winter, and we estimate that we had roughly 900 wolves in the state of Wisconsin. And when you add to that the birth pulse that occurs with pups this year, we may be up into the neighborhood of 1,800 wolves in the state, you know, early on this summer. Now, there's natural mortality with these wolves, and so the population fairly quickly declines. But we still have, you know, maybe in the neighborhood of 1,000 wolves out there, and wolves eat deer. Wolves eat a lot of other things as well, but deer are an important diet item of wolves. And so wolves are taking deer, and hunters view that as competition.
And conservationists have said that wolves keep deer moving and maybe from overgrazing, and that they make the argument that helps hunters. What is their case?
Well, the wolves, I suspect, do keep deer moving. And if you look at research from northern Minnesota, it seems as though deer will congregate in between where the packs occupy the landscape. And so, but if you happen to be a deer hunter and you own a cabin and property in an area where there happens to be a wolf pack and encompassing your area, deer may actually be shifted out of the landscape that you have access to. And so wolves, I think, move deer around in the landscape. They also kill deer and they eat deer, and so they tend to decrease the number of deer that are out on the landscape. They're not eliminating deer, but they do have an impact on the number and on the spatial distribution of deer on the landscape. Some people see this as a positive thing because by shifting deer around, they may reduce crop damage in certain areas. The deer may have less impact on sensitive vegetation or plant communities. But other people, like deer hunters, of which we know there are a lot of them in the state of Wisconsin, they're concerned about the deer that they themselves prize.
How many deer might a wolf pack take in a given season? We probably don't have exact numbers, but is it enough to be significant and really have an impact on a hunt?
Well, I think the numbers vary, but in the neighborhood of probably 50 deer per year, roughly a deer per week on average for a wolf. And so when you do the math, if you spread it out, you know, we have ample numbers of deer to sustain a population of wolves in Wisconsin. Unfortunately, the distributions are such that most of our wolves are in northern Wisconsin and most of our deer are in southern Wisconsin. And so it's a matter of distribution that impacts the numbers of deer that are available for the hunters.
Now, in the past, if you agree with the court rulings and other decisions, we may have taken the wolf off the endangered species list too quickly, or maybe it wasn't as healthy as we thought. So how would you know if an animal like the wolf is ready to be taken off the endangered species list?
Well, that is an issue that is borne largely by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They are the ones that manage wildlife in association with the Endangered Species Act. And they have ruled, I think, four times within the last 15 years that there is a sufficient number of wolves in the upper Midwest, this Great Lakes region, to sustain the population, and that the habitat is suitable for these wolves to sustain a reasonable population. And so thus they proposed to delist the wolf from an endangered species status on one occasion to a threatened species status, and more recently just to drop it so that the states could take over responsibility. Thus, for example, in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources could take over responsibility for managing the wolf population. And in doing so, from 2012 to 2014, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources implemented a hunting or a harvest season that allowed some individuals to, based on a quota, trap and hunt wolves. And so it was our way in which we were managing that wolf population and trying to curb the numbers, because the numbers were over the statewide goal, which was established at 350 wolves in the state. And now we're at, you know, in the neighborhood of a 900 to 1,000 perhaps. So we're still over that goal.
And Scott, just very briefly as we wrap up, what is your sense of how heated this debate is getting to be in northern Wisconsin?
Well, it's a very heated debate, certainly. You have people who have deep-seated interests in wolves and seeing and hearing wolves. And this is all across the state, from Bayfield to Madison to Milwaukee. People love the idea of the opportunity of seeing and hearing wolves. You also have some farmers who live in wolf country who are losing calves and sheep and goats, etc., to wolves. We also have hunters, such as bear hunters, and as a matter of fact, some dogs are taken right off the chain that are just in the backyards. Two wolves, it does happen. And so this is a situation that becomes polarized very quickly, because wolves tug at the heartstrings of some, and they tug at the purse strings of others, and you get this conflict that occurs.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Certainly. Thank you.
Scott Hingstrom was with us talking about the wolf population in Wisconsin. He's a faculty member of the College of Natural Resources at UW-Stevens Point.
Coming up after the news, a look at the best places to look for extraterrestrial life. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we look at the ongoing protests in North Dakota over the Dakota Access Pipeline.
First, the idea of life beyond Earth is one that's fascinated humans for centuries. These days, stories about aliens and creatures from beyond are all over TV and the big screen. Most recently, NASA itself expressed renewed optimism about finding evidence of life on Mars, but it's not the only possible option on the table. Which raises the question, if you had to choose where to send a mission to look for life, where would you pick?
Well, it's an intriguing question, especially when you start thinking about humanity's available resources and funding. So maybe it would help to narrow down the scope a bit. And that's where our next guest comes in. In a new book, he lays out some plausible scenarios for finding extraterrestrial life, the pros and cons of each one, and what life could look like in each case.
John Willis joins us now. He's an associate professor of astronomy at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He's the author of All These Worlds Are Yours, The Scientific Search for Alien Life. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, John, you start off the book with two big statements here. You say aliens exist and there is life beyond planet Earth, probably lots of it. Why can we be confident about that?
Well, that's correct. Well, it's a mathematical argument, and it's basically an unsatisfying one. And it's something your listeners may well have heard before. And the idea is that the universe is a big place, and it's quite possibly infinite in size. It's certainly bigger than we can see, just with our limited horizon. And if you want to play that game of having an infinite universe, then it doesn't matter how small you think the possibility of life beyond Earth is. If it exists, if it's a number, no matter how tiny, then it's got to occur somewhere.
And that's a pretty big starting assumption, but is that enough to launch a probe or a satellite to look for this kind of thing? Are we dedicated to finding this life?
Well, it's not a good enough reason, and that's why you kind of ask a different question. And the different question is, do we have any scientific evidence for life beyond Earth? And the answer to that question is just as resounding a no. And the book is really about how you're actually going to go about tackling that second question, because that's the more interesting one, because that involves actually finding evidence of life, studying it, and learning something about it.
So let's talk about life before we talk about looking for it. I mean, thinking about it in the movie form, we might imagine somebody pulling up in a big spaceship asking for some spare plutonium, but life could be some really, really simple single-celled organism or something like that, couldn't it?
Well, that's probably, based upon what we know from life on Earth, that's the balance of probability, is that when we go out, especially into the solar system with remote probes and go investigating possible habitats, we're much more likely to find primitive, basic, quite hardy life rather than what we would call complex life.
And in setting up your argument before, you know, getting us over our idea of what aliens look like, you also talk about where to look based on what conditions are necessary to form life based on what we know on good old planet Earth. So what do we know about that?
Well, every living creature on planet Earth, whether the smallest microbe or the biggest blue whale, needs essentially three ingredients to keep on living. And that's liquid water, or if you wanted to be more general, some kind of liquid medium in which to perform its chemistry, organic chemicals that are kind of the raw materials of life, and some source of energy to keep it all going. And so the simplest thing we can take from planet Earth is that if we see beyond Earth those three conditions met, that's a potential habitat we should be investigating.
Talking to John Willis, his new book is All These Worlds Are Yours, The Scientific Search for Alien Life. And a lot of what you're doing is kind of almost a triage, I guess, of the search for life. In an infinite universe, we have to pick and choose where to invest our energy. Why is that important as a first step?
Well, I mean, I could have written a book where I talked about all of the possibilities, endless possibilities, but the reader, I'd be doing the reader a disservice, because you've got to help them, give them the education to winnow away at those ideas, to actually get the wheat from the chaff. And one of the best ways to focus someone's minds on that question is just to remind them we have limited resources. We can't fund space missions everywhere in the solar system. We can't go to every nook and cranny. So the question is, if I gave you a reasonable amount of money equivalent to a major space mission, well, after reading the book, where would you as the reader want to put your money?
And it seems like one obvious starting point might be Mars. For one thing, we've thought that there might be life there in the past, and there's sort of this cultural imagination around it. But also, it looks like there was evidence of water on Mars, at least at one point. So maybe there was life in the past, maybe the distant past there. So what about Mars?
Mars is really enigmatic, and it's a great option. And unsurprisingly, that's why we're sending so many probes to Mars, both to orbit it and explore the surface with rovers, this kind of thing. Because certainly when you look back in its distant past, and when I say distant, I mean really early in Mars's history, say between 3 and 4 billion years ago, when the evidence that we have for Mars at the moment shows that in all respects, it seemed to be quite similar to Earth. We believe it had large amounts of liquid water on the surface. It had some kind of thick atmosphere that enabled that liquid water to exist. And we believe that those are the same kinds of conditions that were prevalent on Earth. And so if, as we have evidence for, life on Earth 3 billion years ago, then it naturally poses the question, well, did life arise on Mars as well? And could we find evidence for that today? So that's a really interesting option.
And with our current efforts on Mars, with the Mars rovers out there, are we putting a lot of priority into searching for evidence of life, a past or more likely present, on Mars?
Well, what I would do is, I would say it's more what we're exploring Mars at the moment in the context of really basic planetary exploration. Okay, there are so many questions that we don't know about Mars, don't know the answers to about Mars, that really we're doing a lot of basic research. And if you can think about it, that basic research is almost like examining the haystack. And all of the strands of straw are interesting. They give us some kind of knowledge. Life, if it exists on Mars, is kind of the needle in the haystack, that in doing that basic exploration, we're going to find something one day, possibly, that doesn't make sense, doesn't add up with what we expect. And that might be the kind of clue we're looking for.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Mark with us in New Berlin. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You asked where I would look if I was asking you to store, I had money to spend. I would look at it two ways. I would look at orbiting or extraterrestrial telescopes to look at planets that transit their star, and we can look at their atmospheres spectrographically to determine whether or not they'd have things that would be associated with life, at least as we know it. The other thing I would do is I would have a probe or multiple probes going to the Galilean moons on Jupiter, as well as Titan on Saturn, liquid methane, liquid water on both of those atmospheres. I think the one thing that we're probably wasting our time on is radio telescoping, looking for signals, because as we're seeing on our own planet, as electronics advance, the level and the powers transmitted for radio and television is actually dropping, and it's becoming more directional, and we're not just broadcasting it all over the universe.
Mark, thanks a lot. Lots of great thoughts there. He seems to be on the right track in a lot of ways, at least in line with what you're thinking, John. So what about some of Mark's ideas, including pointing telescopes there, doing some analysis about signs of alien life, and using things like rovers and probes?
Well, Mark is clearly a very well-informed listener, and he's read the book in some detail because he's nailed all the major points of the book there in one series of comments. I have no problem with what he says.
Well, let's narrow it down a little bit, and the next further out, a moon around Jupiter, you think, would be a potential scenario for finding life?
Well, I think I know what you're getting at there. And so, I mean, really, if you were to ask people a very simple question, where do you think most of the liquid water resides in the solar system, right? I think before I ask that question in such a suspicious way, most people would say planet Earth, okay? Mm. But it turns out not to be the case. It turns out to be one of the moons of Jupiter, Europa, that when you actually look at the results of analysis from the Galileo space probe and work out how much water these results point to, it's about two times the volume of liquid water that exists on Earth is underneath the ice of that moon in orbit around Jupiter.
So that seems like a fertile place to start, but I mean, this is all covered in ice, so if you want to ascertain whether or not there's life there, how do you get a sample? How do you get close enough and get what you need?
Well, you've really got two options. One is drill for all you're worth, okay? That is, once you've actually got your drilling rig all the way out to Jupiter and landed it safely on Europa. And that's a tall order, because even at the moment, we don't know exactly how thick the ice sheet is on Europa. Might be 5 kilometers, might be 10, might be 30 kilometers. And that's starting to become a pretty tall order. Option two is only possibly slightly less difficult, but I think it's quite achievable, and that's go one planet further out to Saturn, where there's a slightly smaller ice moon called Enceladus that we believe has a similar liquid water ocean or reservoir underneath its icy surface. The difference there is that the Cassini space probe has imaged geysers of water, in this case water vapor and ice crystals, venting out through cracks on the south pole of Enceladus, actually taking some of that ice water and venting it into space, where a suitable probe could actually capture some of that material and possibly analyze it, or even more boldly, return it to Earth.
We're talking with astronomy professor John Willis about the search for alien life in our solar system, around the universe, and where we might possibly find it in the coming decades. John is the author of the new book, All These Worlds Are Yours.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were in charge of a life-finding mission for NASA, maybe another space agency, where would you look? And why? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How invested or excited are you in the idea of finding life elsewhere in the universe? You can let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time.
We're talking to astronomy professor John Willis. He's the author of the new book, All These Worlds Are Yours, The Scientific Search for Alien Life. And we're looking at the most likely places in the universe where alien life could exist.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you got put in charge of the budget for finding life elsewhere in the solar system or beyond, where do you think we should start? Mars? Some of the moons of Jupiter or Saturn? Extrasolar planets? If we do find life, what do you think that'll mean for humans and our place in the universe? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our next caller now. Chance is with us in Osseo. Hi there.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling in regard to the previous caller who recommended the elimination of radio telescopes, and the guests seemed to agree. And I haven't read the book, and I'm not an expert on these things, but my understanding was that because of our current technology, it's unlikely to find just randomly broadcast radio waves emitting from some distant celestial object. But doesn't it stand to reason that aliens also, or, you know, extraterrestrial life also, if they had technology, it went through an evolution, and that they indeed, at one time, we're also transmitting random radio waves throughout the universe?
Okay, Chance, what do you think about that, John?
Well, I think that's a great point, and I should clarify my earlier statement that I certainly wouldn't recommend closing down any of these projects that under which we all call them SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I mean, it's a my position is, in the book at least, is slightly more particular. I say I wouldn't spend any of my money on it. I put my money onto what I think are better options, space probes to the moons of the solar system and a particularly impressive telescope, okay? But I'm really pleased that some people are willing to put their money where their mouth is and actually fund these projects. In particular, I'm thinking of the Breakthrough Foundation that's funding to the tune of about $100 million the Breakthrough Listen project, which is essentially private money which is underwriting the SETI program. And I certainly don't rule out the fact that we're going to detect an alien signal that way, but on the whole I'd be surprised. Okay, that's kind of my personal position, and it's not one you can really come up with a huge amount of equations to support, but it's really the fact that, as the caller points out, that at some point in their past history, any advanced alien civilization, if it exists, may well have been broadcasting randomly into space. But the question is, how likely is that over the volume of space over which we'd be sensitive to those signals? And that's really a number that nobody is able to work out in any rigorous way. And that's one of the issues I have with SETI. And as I say, because of that, if I was limited to $4 billion, I'd probably put my money elsewhere. But the fact that other people are willing to fund it and take that chance, I'm completely happy with.
Thanks for that call. And John, I wonder, with looking the idea of trying to detect life outside the solar system, we're getting pretty good, it seems like, at detecting planets. We have some idea like where the planet could be, what size, that it might be able to sustain life. But if we're assuming a non-technological alien life form on another planet, do we have anywhere near the kind of technology we would need to detect something like that?
We do, and we're getting better every day. I mean, what technique you would use to try and identify life on one of these extrasolar planets is to look and see if it has an atmosphere. Okay. Now, as you mentioned, we can measure some things about these planets already. We can measure, in some cases, their masses, their sizes, and from that we can get their density. And we can say, well, does it have the density of rock? Is it like a rocky planet like Earth, or is it the density of gas like Jupiter or Saturn? Okay, so we can tell something about the physical nature of the planet. And if we happen to find a rocky planet that has an atmosphere on it, well, we're just now at the stage where our technology is able to take a spectrum of the starlight as it passes through the atmosphere of that planet, as once every orbit the planet passes in front of its parent star. And once we do that, we actually get, for a brief moment, a glimpse through the atmosphere. And that gives us kind of a fingerprint of the chemical elements that may be present in that atmosphere. And what you're really looking for, once again, is you may have to look at thousands of planets and their atmospheres, and you'll start to learn about all the different physics that determines how those atmospheres are made up. And in one or two cases, I think, you're going to find some surprises, some oddballs, that needle in the haystack again. And that's what we're going to focus on. We're going to look at those and say perhaps there might be abundant atmospheric oxygen or methane beyond what we would expect. And those are going to be, I wouldn't say unambiguous cases of potentially life on those planets, but those oddballs are the ones we're going to follow up.
We're talking with John Willis right now, Associate Professor of Astronomy at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, talking about his new book, All These Worlds Are Yours, The Scientific Search for Alien Life, trying to narrow down the possibilities for where in the universe to look to find alien life. And we'll take our next caller now. We've got Steve with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. It might be something I just read about in science fiction 40 years ago, but I'm wondering whether anyone who's seriously informed is looking at alternate to carbon-based life forms, if anyone is considering the existence of silicon-based life forms or others that don't require water, so that you could look on extraterrestrial objects where they don't have water, that you might find some life form other than carbon-based.
Steve, thanks a lot. What about that non-carbon-based life forms, John?
Well, that's a really good question. And, I mean, and as the caller points out, this has been discussed as, you know, all the wide variety of possibilities for life have been discussed really well in science fiction, okay? And that's great for firing the imagination. In terms of actually understanding life in a laboratory environment, at the moment we're really limited, and we're limited by what we know about Earth life. And the saying I keep telling my students and my classes is, you've got to start with what you know, okay? So we're starting to look for primitive life in the solar system that is broadly similar to Earth-based life. And you might well say, correctly, well, that's a really narrow perspective. You know, what happens if there's some kind of weird, funky life out there that doesn't match your expectations? You won't find it, and that's correct. But really, you've got to start with some known template. Try and push it. Push your assumptions in any way possible. For example, you might look for carbon-based life, not in liquid water, but as one earlier caller pointed out, in liquid methane or ethane on Saturn's moon Titan. But you've really got to start with what you know about life and then start to push the envelope of those assumptions. That's kind of the current strategy.
We've been talking mostly about the how and where, John, of finding alien life. You also write a little bit about when, you know, whether we're talking a decade or 100 years or 1,000 years before we humans find some other form of life. Ballpark, what are you thinking? What's your bet?
Oh, my bet. Christ, what odds are you giving me?
I'll let you set the odds.
I think, if you were to choose between 10 years, 100 years, and 1,000 years, for me, 100 years is a challenging timescale. And I don't mean challenging because it's necessarily impossibly difficult, because it challenges us as human beings and scientists and engineers to actually come up with ideas, to fund them and fly them, and actually go to the locations in the solar system that we think are promising options at the moment, and actually perform rigorous tests in those locations. 100 years is about long enough to do that across the solar system. And whether we'll find something, even if we don't, we're going to learn an awful lot about the possible rarity of life or otherwise.
And you seem, especially at the end of your book, John, pretty bullish about the largest moon of Saturn, Titan. What is it about Saturn? Is that where you might be persuaded to put a bet?
Is that where all the action is? Yeah, I'd certainly throw a... as I talk in the book, I think the idea of going to the, not Titan, but in particular Enceladus, and actually flying through these plumes of material, these geysers, and collecting material from them, that's a really compelling option. It's almost like you're getting a free sample of a habitat under these ice sheets. Titan is different altogether, and that's what makes it so interesting. It's not so much that it's cold, it's that there is abundant liquid on the surface. It's liquid methane and liquid ethane. And so if there is life on Titan, it's going to do exactly what I mentioned to your previous question. It's going to push our assumptions about what life can possibly be into interesting new directions. And so it would be wrong of me to talk about the probability of finding life there. I have no idea about the probability. But if we do find some kind of organisms on Titan, they're going to be amazingly interesting compared to anything we've ever seen on Earth.
John, thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We've been talking to John Willis. He's an associate professor of astronomy at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He's the author of the new book, All These Worlds Are Yours, The Scientific Search for Alien Life. Well, tell us where you think we should be spending our limited resources to look for life in the solar system and beyond. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or as always, you can send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page.
Hi. They're into the machinery, all right. And they're probably in all the other food processors, too.
How?
Probably through one of the air vents.
Captain, there are vents of that type on the space station.
And in the storage compartments.
That's the crew of the Enterprise trying to get to the bottom of a major infestation of Tribbles, one of my favorite episodes, by the way. That's from the original series of the now legendary Star Trek franchise.
Today marks the 50th anniversary of the show's debut, with another movie out earlier this summer, a new TV series in the works for next year. Star Trek did okay in the long run.
Yeah, putting it mildly, right? It's still got legs or wings, whatever you want to say.
Furry little blobs like the Tribbles.
It's an exciting time to be a Star Trek fan. I'm thinking there might be a whole next generation of Star Trek fans on the way.
Yeah, definitely. It's one people can keep getting back into. And that's one, if, you know, I've always liked it. Okay, I've never been a hardcore fan. But that's something, if you discover it at any point, you're in luck. Because there is a whole lot of catching up to do. You're set for your binge watching for days, weeks, and months.
And quickly, Rob, do you have a favorite captain? Janeway, Kirk, Picard.
Deep Space Nine, Commander Sisko.
Sisko.
Big fan.
Right. I'm going to go with Kirk, I think.
Okay.
I've come full
Classic.
Circle.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.